Welcome to your second class, and we're looking at multiculturalism and diversity in Britain. And today, some history and a bit of video and some questions. I started last week and I talked about the concepts and a couple of just amusing examples. And then I began with history, and I wanted to look briefly. Please stay with us. Thank you. Okay, I wanted to look at a bit at the history of the different groups, and I began with the history of Jewish immigration to Britain. Now, I have a video to show you, but it's on the internet, and there's no internet, so there's no video. But it will come next week, don't worry, the video will come next week. And I have one video, which I have here, which is for later. And so I took you through a little bit of the history of the a long time ago, and the waves of immigration, then the first small wave of immigration, really, in the 18th century, partly from Jews who had been expelled from Spain and Portugal, then later their fortunes in the 19th century, when it was possible to join the elite. We had a Jewish prime minister, yeah, if you can become a prime minister. We haven't had a Muslim prime minister in France. So in the 19th century in Britain, it was possible to join the elite, although, of course, most people were not part of the elite. And then the next big wave of immigration is at the end of the 19th century. This is a time when in Russia, in Poland, it's very dangerous to be Jewish. I'm going to shoot you. You're dead now. Right, okay, so it's very dangerous to be Jewish, so you get a large number of people, I mentioned this, coming to Britain just to save their lives, and very often desperately poor people, extremely poor. And this is a Jews' temporary shelter established in 1885, and you can see it's written in English and in Hebrew, I think. I assume. And this is because some of the Jewish community present wanted to help these people who are arriving, refugees really, who were in a terrible situation. And they all moved to the same part of London, the East End of London, which has become, and still is today, the Jewish quarter of London. The existing Jewish community was a little divided because some of them thought, oh, we don't want... You know, now we finally have some acceptance inside the British community. We don't want all these really poor Jews arriving. They're not educated. They will ruin our reputation. So, and then other sections of the Jewish community say, no, we must help them. So there's a division, as there always is. There's always a division. And so they moved into the East End of London. And this was the occasion for one of the first anti-racist campaigns in Britain. Remember, the word racist did not exist at this time. The word racist did not exist. This does not mean that racism existed, but the word racism didn't exist. Some historians said recently, Victorian and Edwardian racism was a phenomenon which did not know itself and had not been named. Yeah, so it wasn't named. But this was the first anti-racist campaign. And you can say it is against the inhuman treatment and persecution of Jews in Russia. And it's a very interesting idea because you can see that there would be 20 speakers. Would you like to go to a political meeting with 20 speakers? Yeah, it sounds a lot, doesn't it? Remember, of course, there is no competition from the radio, the television, the internet, the gramophone. None of those exist. So people will come to these meetings with 20 speakers. Some of these are famous. Eleanor Marx, it's Karl Marx's daughter. Karl Marx's daughter. Who else is famous here? William Morris, a famous artist. Michael Davitt, a famous Irish nationalist. Yeah, so a lot of people come early to get a seat. Yes, and they might begin with some songs. They might begin the meeting with some songs about liberation. William Morris and his friends liked to do this. But of course, if there was an anti-racist mobilization, there was also, you will not be surprised to see, a racist mobilization. And so here you have one of the demonstrations against the refugees. A great public demonstration under the auspices of the British Brothers League. And you see the name British Brothers League, it sounds, doesn't it? It sounds pretty much like it's going to be rather exclusive. And indeed there they are at the People's Palace in Mile End. So in the East End of London, in the Jewish part of London, they're having this demonstration. Led by a Member of Parliament, and which will include Ministers of Religion and so on, yes? They say the reason for the demonstration is to restrict the further immigration of destitute foreigners, very poor foreigners. So they don't say Jews, but everybody understands, yeah? Everybody understands, yes? So they use codes, and this is 1902, a campaign against immigrants, and here you can see Britannia. This is a cartoon from somebody who is anti-racist, and they are shocking. Here is Britannia stopping the Jews, saying, no, we don't want you, yeah, we don't want you. Yeah, the humorous cartoons at the time seem rather difficult for us today, rather tame. Not always, but rather tame. So the campaign against immigrants in 1902. So the community, this is a very, very rapid history, of course. The community established itself in the East End of London, and here you have, yeah, London, United Synagogue London, and this is the manuscript or the parchment which is used in a Jewish marriage in 1904. In the East End of London then, a lot of Jewish people arriving, very poor, but quite often very educated. The Jewish populations of Russia and Poland were quite often educated, but then they had to leave, and so they left with nothing. And so you get quite a lot of artists and writers in the East End of London, Jewish artists and writers, and one of them wrote a play, and the title of the play is so famous that you have all heard the title. This is the origin of the expression, the melting pot. Yeah, the people have forgotten the origin, but it came from this play by Israel Tzangwill. Okay, so we can see he's Jewish, Israel Tzangwill, yeah? Okay, and this is The Melting Pot, The Great American Dream. And it's about America, and you can see what's happening. All of these people are arriving from all over the world, coming past the Statue of Liberty in New York, and they had to go to Ellis Island for immigration control. And they are coming, and they're all falling into this very, very hot American melting pot, which will melt them, and which will produce Americans. Yeah, they came from, you know, Poland, Norway, Italy, and they're becoming Americans. Of course, this concept of creating America only includes the white immigrants. Yeah, nobody is talking about the black immigrants. This is in the 1900s, at the very beginning then of the 20th century. The East End of London also developed quite a powerful trade union movement. And here we have an example of a trade union banner. And you can see it is written, so this is from London. And you can see it is written in Hebrew at the top, but in English at the side. And it has the same typical slogans you have on trade union banners at the time. We're marching towards the morning. We're struggling, comrades all. Our aims are set on victory, our enemies must fall. With ordered step and flag unfurled, we'll build a new and better world. Yeah, this is a period when still quite a lot of the population could not vote, and so they often felt that trade unions were the way to change the world. At the beginning of, in 1882, only about one third of the men in Britain could vote. And no women. And so it was not a very democratic place. So 1882 trade union. if we stay in London with the Jewish community, but we can we go 50 years later, we find some artists who became quite well known from here. And here you have a painting of Isaac Rosenberg. And Isaac Rosenberg is a recognized poet in the English language. And there you can see then poetry out of my head and heart, which is, that's letters and that's poems. Isaac Rosenberg, one of the Jewish British people who have made a little impact in culture. As I give you these histories, I'm going to go through Jewish immigration, then Irish immigration, then Caribbean immigration, and then Indian and Pakistani immigration. And every time I like to give you a few examples of individuals who have made their mark, because as I mentioned before, the history of racism is very depressing. So I like to give you some of the less depressing elements. In the Jewish community, early 20th century, we also have then this gentleman, Mark Gertler, a painter, died in his 40s, but first of all made a certain impact on the world of painting. This is one of the Greater London Council blue plaques, which have been developed since the 1960s. There are hundreds of them in London now, where you can see some places where remarkable people lived and worked. Here is just one of Mark Gertler's paintings, so you can recognise perhaps the style of modern art from the first half of the 20th century, a particular use of colours. As I mentioned, there was a strong tradition of education in the Jewish community, and so also in the theatre there were a number of successes. Indeed, one of the most famous British playwrights of the 20th century was Jewish. You may have heard the name of Harold Pinter. Harold Pinter is a playwright and dramaturg. I couldn't find a photograph of him, but here is a photograph of one of his plays. It doesn't really show you very much, but there you go. Yes, he wrote in the 1950s and 1960s in particular plays about ordinary life. Another painter who caused a little controversy more recently, so now we're moving right up to the last 30 or 40 years, a Jewish painter, Lucian Freud. He was a descendant of Sigmund Freud, the founder of psychoanalysis. Vous aurez peut-être vu la différence entre la langue française et la langue anglaise. En France, on a tendance à francifier les noms. Alors, on parle de Freud. Et en anglais, on essaye de prononcer à l'original, donc c'est Freud. C'est important parce que si vous dites Freud en anglais, personne, vous pouvez répéter 20 fois, personne ne va savoir de qui vous parlez. Okay, so we do tend to do this. Here you have two. First of all, on the right, you have a sleeping person. And then on the left, you have a rather surprising painting of, I recognize, it's Elizabeth. It's Queen Elizabeth. She says hello. I had her on the phone yesterday. And so Queen Elizabeth, and this is a very, very interesting portrait because usually, when you see a portrait of a king or queen, it's usually very idealized. And that's the typical portrait of, you've seen, you may have seen some of them in the art galleries, very idealized. And this is something new, in fact, because as you can see, it is not idealized. Do you think she liked it? Okay, how many people think she did not like it? How many people think she liked it? Okay, so we'll have a few people here. Now, we don't know, of course, because she doesn't give her opinion, but she asked him to paint it. And she knows what kind of work he does. And she's not completely stupid. So, you know, she might have liked, and of course she might not have liked it, but I would say that, you know, although obviously she doesn't look young and beautiful, but then, you know, I don't look young and beautiful either. So what can you do? But I think that, you know, it could be seen as positive in some way. I think she looks rather determined. Yeah. I think that it's... I quite like it, and I don't like kings and queens, but I quite like this portrait. But there's something interesting in it. I think you can see that it's more interesting than a painting of the queen where she looks young and beautiful, yeah, which is just another old-fashioned thing. And that's what art is supposed to do something new. One more Jewish painter who came to Britain in the 1940s, Oskar Kokoschka. He came from Germany, or Austria perhaps, I'm not sure, because of the terrible massacres there. And what I like about Oskar Kokoschka is that he continued painting until he was like 96 or something. He continued painting very, very old, so Oskar Kokoschka. There was also a... En fait, j'ai oublié ce que c'est ça, alors je vais le laisser. Yeah, another one, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It must be Kokoschka as well, I think. There was a tradition of Jewish activity in entertainment, and one of the great stars of the 1950s and 1960s, Joe Loss, was from a Jewish family, and this was the time of the big band. This is before when the amplifiers were not strong enough. In the 1950s, it was not possible to make 100 people dance with a record because the amplification was not strong enough. If you wanted 100 people to dance, you needed a real band with real instruments. There was no other technical solution. And the conductors of the great bands, like Joe Loss, were stars of the time. If we move over to novels, one British Jewish novelist who made a particular impact is Arthur Koestler. And that's one of Arthur Koestler's many books, The 13th Tribe. Well worth a go. Also in acting, one of the famous comic actors of the 60s, Peter Sellers, who played Inspector Clouseau in the films. He was of Jewish family as well. Now, Inspector Clouseau is that you can see his character there, Inspector Clouseau, which is a rather fascinating character, and it allows the English to laugh at the French. He's supposed to be French, and he sounds very ridiculous, and he speaks with a very strong French accent, and English people think this is funny, which is not very polite. But there you go. More recently, Jewish British stars, Amy Winehouse, quite a significant singer, I think, and of course, who died tragically young. And finally, in politics, there was a few well-known people in politics. There's this gentleman, Tony Cliff, whose original name was Egail Gluckstein. He died in 2000, and he was the most prominent leader of the extreme left. So c'était un peu le Olivier Besancenot de l'Angleterre de l'époque, mais bon, plus vieux. But very 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 impressive speaker. Okay, so that was my story of Jewish immigration, and now is the moment you were supposed to see a video, but there's no internet, so you're not going to see a video. But I do have a video for you a little later on. So if we move on to a short history of Irish immigration, I showed you last week that Irish immigration was, for a long time, the biggest one. Ireland is not very far away. And so, although of course it was further away 100 years ago, I mean, it was harder to move. And so you got quite a large amount of seasonal migration where people lived at home and they came to England to work on the railways in the winter and then went back to the farm at those times when it's important to have a lot of people at the farm. I know nothing about farming, but I think it's in the autumn. In the autumn, you need people on the farm to bring everything in, I think. Yeah, I get everything from a supermarket, so I wouldn't know. So, a short history of Irish immigration. And the first thing to notice about Irish immigration is that the Irish identity seems to be very strong and quite persistent. So if you go to New York in America and somebody says, "Oh, I'm Irish," you could say, "Oh, have you ever been to Ireland?" And they might say, "No." "Has your father ever been to Ireland or your mother?" No, but we're Irish because we came from Ireland. That people maintain this identity for a long time. And of course, you have a choice. My great grandparents were Irish, but our family chose we didn't want to be Irish, not me. And so we became English. But if you want to, you can continue. And here you see some very interesting things. First of all, Liverpool Irish Festival in 2009. Now, this does not mean an Irish festival in Liverpool. This means a festival for the people who are Liverpool Irish. That Liverpool Irish is an identity, which is a very, very interesting thing. Like you have New York Irish. It's an actual identity. I don't know if you have this in France. Of course, people can feel Algerian, but I don't... Oh, maybe Marseille. Marseille Algerian? Is it possible? Not really. It's a very English thing. It's black or white. It's very English thing. And we have another one here. You see, this is just a cup, and it says Manchester Irish. And again, that's who we are. It's a very interesting thing to have on a cup, actually, Manchester Irish. And it, obviously, it's supposed to be a positive reference. You can see four-leaf clover, which is supposed to be lucky. We're Manchester Irish. And this is not a small, marginal event. It is sponsored by the main Liverpool newspaper and also sponsored by Guinness, which is a very rich country. So it's become something... This was not directly political, but I think it does go together with the ways which multiculturalism has been thought about in Britain. It's something which is very, very, very British. And the Irish were probably the first. I can imagine people saying, "I'm Manchester Irish," 100 years ago. I think it was already possible. So it was multiculturalism before multiculturalism, if you like. Because the modern idea, the word multiculturalism, is really a 1960s, 1970s word. Now that's when the idea arrives. Now, the Irish in Britain had a traditional... of course, most of them came to England. They were working class. They were not from the elites. They came to England to work on the railways, to build the motorways. And the textile industry. My great-grandparents and my grandparents all worked in textiles. And dying and so on. And because of this, some of them became quite prominent in the Labour Party. And indeed, in the 1970s, one of the prime ministers, James Callaghan, was of Irish extraction. And just a little bit before him, Dennis Healy was Chancellor of the Exchequer, with incredible eyebrows here, and an incredible voice he used to have. There are some British Irish scientists. Here we have Robert Boyle. Oh, this is going back a long time. This is not very important. This is a bit of a joke, but he invented. He worked at the same time. He worked before Lavoisier, I think, or at the same time as Lavoisier, and he invented some stuff about gas, some laws about gas. More famous Irish people living in Britain. Of course, there is this gentleman who maybe you've heard of, a playwright, Oscar Wilde, and. Very traditional Irish humour. He was supposed to have said, "There is only one thing in the world which is worse than being talked about." and that is not being talked about. Yeah, it's very, like, very 19th century humour, if you like. Now you can see this statue is actually in Ireland, but there's something rather unusual about this statue. You can see it's not a traditional classical statue. Yeah, he's not stood on a podium dressed in Roman robes in grey. He's in colours. What? Well, first of all, can you imagine when this statue was established? When it was erected? Good idea. No, not at all. It's about 20 years old. It's in the 21st century. And the reason is, this is where I'm coming to, the reason is in the 19th century and the 20th century, nobody wanted a statue of Oscar Wilde. Why not? Because he was gay. Yeah. He is famous because he's famous for writing plays, but he's also famous because he was sent to prison. He was sent to prison for a long time at the very beginning of the 20th century because he was gay. And that meant that, you know, don't talk about Oscar Wilde for a long time. The 20th century was an incredibly homophobic century. And so when finally we got over that, then you got the recent statue of Oscar Wilde. And this is why it's a very modern statue in colour, lying down and so on, Oscar Wilde. You can still occasionally see his stuff. La version film est passée à la télé il y a 6 mois, donc comme quoi il existe encore. The importance of being earnest, c'est l'importance d'être constant. Traduit en français. And this is, it's not Marivaux, but it's very close in some ways. It's all about, je pensais que vous étiez une femme, et en fait vous êtes un homme, c'est parce que vous êtes mon serviteur déguisé pour essayer de séduire, vous voyez le genre. Hein? Yeah, it's that kind of play. But very well done. Other British-Irish intellectuals, George Bernard Shaw. George Bernard Shaw wrote plays at the beginning of the 20th century, in 1905, 1910, 1915. George Bernard Shaw was the biggest playwright. And at the time, the theatre was very important. No television, no radio. Cinema, but only silent cinema. You've got Charlie Chaplin and so on. And George Bernard Shaw wrote plays, and he wrote very political plays. He wrote a play about prostitution, and he wrote another play about the suffragettes. And he was the guy who would bring out these things, pour le Ken Loach de l'époque. George Bernard Shaw. Other famous English-Irish people, the Bronte sisters. The Bronte sisters, yeah, they're very, very popular. Interesting, if you look at the word, their name Bronte, where does that come from? It's difficult to say. If you're English, you say, is it French? Now, you're French, so you know it's not French. But in English, it looks French. And in fact, their original name was Irish, Punty, P-U-N-T-Y, qui fait fermier irlandais. And so they thought, we're not going to have this. And so they changed their name because they wanted to sound less Irish. And they were called Bronte. And of course, they became the mistresses, the best of the new novel genre. And in particular, the romantic novel genre. Another Irish artist living in Britain who you will know of is not the lion. The lion is not Irish, but C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis. Now, C.S. Lewis wrote the books of Narnia, and unfortunately, in France, the books were forgotten until the film came out. But now now they have translated the books. The books are very interesting. C.S. Lewis was a very Catholic novelist, in his books he has the story, and then he stops the story to give his conservative politics for 5 pages, and then he stops the story again. It's very, very, it's very, 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 very clearly put forward. And I think even when you see the films, you can see them as pretty Christian. You know, the lion tends to represent a sort of Christ figure, and it's all very moral. It's all very moral. In music, there is, as is well known, a very long tradition of Irish music. Irish folk music is very popular. In fact, in the at La Défense on the 7th of March, there's a big soirée celtique with Irish and Breton players. And so I just wanted to take one example. This is the Pogues. And the Pogues did something new because they took traditional Irish music and they mixed it up with punk rock. And they sort of put it together and mixed it all together. And it was something which had a particular influence in the 1970s, which brings us back to the question of identity. What is the national day of the Irish? Which day every year do the Irish celebrate? That's right, yeah, St. Patrick, yeah. St. Patrick. And St. Patrick's Day, the St. Patrick's Day parade in London can get quite a lot of people in. So this is an interesting idea, these festivals, because sometimes when you go to live in another country, you like to keep your traditional festivals in Huon. Will there be a festival in a few weeks' time for the Chinese New Year? There is one in Paris, in Belleville. There is always the tradition for the Chinese New Year. I discovered this yesterday because one of my neighbours is Chinese. And I said to him, alors, comment va la nouvelle année? Et il me répond, mais c'est pas encore. Oh, yeah, okay, right. I was too early. There you go. A couple of months more. So, the St. Patrick's Day parade. Now, the Irish coming to England, as many groups coming to England, had to deal with racism. And here you have an example from the 19th century. This is from Punch magazine, which is a very important magazine, which has this racist cartoon about the Irish. And it says that in the zoo we call the monkeys by Irish names, and this is not fair on the monkeys. Yeah, so it's a very classic racist piece. Yeah. Now, racism against Irish people is much less today, but you can still find it. You can still find it. This is one from in the 1970s. You can see in the middle there is the British Army, and on the two sides you can see racist stereotypes of Irish people, and you can see from their faces that they are being presented as, you know, as primitive, yeah, as primitive animal, pre-human things. So this is very, very classic, of course, and we can see it again. Even today, the Irish government in Ireland is still interested in Irish people in England. So here, for example, we can see this is a headline from an Irish newspaper, and it says Ireland, that is the Irish government, is going to give €6 million to the Irish community in Britain. Yeah. And so they are going to help out. Yeah. So this is the idea of the diaspora. Just like in France, you have les Français de l'étranger. Il y a des députés à Paris qui représentent les Français à l'étranger. Ils votent pour des députés spécifiques pour les représenter. So this is the idea of the diaspora. And here you have another articulation of this idea of the diaspora, where the Irish government is sending money to England to help the Irish people living in England. There's another example. The appetite for Irish film in London continues to grow. In London, every year, they have the Irish Film Festival. They have an Irish film festival, which obviously interests in particular the Irish people living in Britain. So these are interesting phenomena, and you can see that a large number of Irish people living in Britain are not trying to stop being Irish. They are not interested in assimilation. They want to remain Irish, or even have a hybrid identity. We are Manchester Irish. We are Liverpool Irish. Yeah. So this is the idea of a hybrid identity. I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. We're not interested really in whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. We just want to see if we can understand how it goes together. One last example here. Yeah, there's the St. Patrick Parade in 2018 in London. It all goes very fast. That was very fast. We've done Jews and the Irish. Let's move on to the next group. A history of Southeast Asian immigration to Britain. And then after that, the last one will be Caribbean. But we'll have a video between the two of them, I think. So Southeast Asian, where is Southeast Asia? Well, Southeast Asia is India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. In the way that the English see it. And the reason they're important is that India, before 1947, India was a colony of Britain, and India at the time included Pakistan and Bangladesh. It was a very unusual colony, because there were 40 million people in Britain and 200 million people in India. Normally, when you have a colony, you have a big country and smaller populations who are in the colonies. That's the normal way of doing things. So India was really a very, very surprising colony. It was extremely profitable for the British. They got the biggest diamond in the world, which is in Paris now, was taken by the British from India. And that was just a symbol. It was a tradition in the 19th century and the end of the 18th century, if you were the son of a bourgeois, to go to India and come back 10 years later with £1 million, yeah, the equivalent at the time. Yeah, it was big money could be made. But it all began rather surprisingly, because at the very beginning, the colonization of India was organized by a private company. It was like privatized colonization. This is the East India Company. This was their headquarters in London. And what happened was the king said, okay, your company, you can have the monopoly on trading with India. And you can do what you like on behalf of the crown. But it was a rather unusual company, because the company had a private army. And also the company produced its own money. So it was a rather straight, it was like more powerful than McDonald's, you know. Even McDonald's don't have a private army. The East India Company gradually annexed, using crime, really, gradually annexed more and more of India until the whole of India was under British control. Je vais juste voir qu'est-ce que j'ai là. Ah oui, d'accord, okay. Okay. This was, of course, very difficult for a small British population in India to control the whole of India. But they managed it, and in particular, at the beginning, they were very careful to find local allies, and they were very careful not to attack the local religion. So, for example, before 1812, the East India Company did not allow any evangelists, no missionaries in India, because they saw that this could be, they were more pragmatic. They wanted to make money. They didn't want to upset any religious. However, in the 19th century, there was an evangelical movement in Britain and in America, there was more and more pressure in India to try to tell Indians, you have the wrong religion, you should be Christian. And this, as well as very, very high taxes, led to an enormous revolt in 1857. 1857, the Great Indian Revolt. And this is a fascinating revolt, because if you read a British book, very often they say, the Indian Mutiny of 1857. And if you read an Indian book, they say, the First War for Indian Independence. Yeah, it's the same war, it's just two points of view. It was extremely violent, and of course, because the British had an army and the Indian didn't, the British won easily, there are stories of really horrible, gory stories, which I'm not going to tell you, but you can imagine, yeah, when colonies try to get independence and they don't get it, the colonizers are not very polite about it, yeah. So one thing they used to do is that in the local religion, it was very important for your body, when you died, to remain in good condition. And so what the British did with the prisoners is they tied them to the cannons, and they fired cannons through them to kill them. And so they were dead, and also religiously they could not, in their religion, go to heaven. Yeah. So it was a really sort of reign of terror there. After that, of course, things got better because there was the beginnings of a of an independence movement in Britain, in India. So after the 1857 rebellion and massacre, the British said, "Okay, well let's have a bit of an Indian middle class. Let's allow Indians to become lawyers and doctors and so on, and maybe that will calm them down." And of course, this has been tried many times, and usually the result is that the new middle class say, "Hey, why don't we have more independence?" And indeed, the Indian independence movement became more and more powerful, and one of its leaders is world famous, of course, Gandhi, who came to lead it, which is interesting because most leaders of colonial liberation movements have been forgotten and you don't know their names. So Gandhi had something for him. Certainly he was a very impressive guy. At the time, they used to have caste rules in India. So some of the people were called untouchables. You were not allowed to touch them. And when Gandhi came to a meeting, he would see the audience segregated into two, the people and the untouchables. And he would say, "Oh, well, I'm going to talk to the untouchables. And if you take the separation down, I will talk to you as well." So really a pretty impressive guy. Yeah, he really do it. I mean, he was certainly not as perfect as he appears to be in the films, you know, who is. But pretty impressive and mostly successful. And so in 1947, India finally gained its independence. They had a bit of a problem. For many, many years, the British had been trying to divide the Muslims and the Hindus, divide and rule. And so the 1947 independence came in a period where there was a lot of conflict between Hindus and Muslims, and eventually it was decided to have a separate state for Muslims, Pakistan and India. This was pretty tragic because many, many people died in the change. Yeah, but bizarrely enough, the British drew the line between Pakistan and India, and they drew it in secret. So when they had the celebrations for the independence of India, and then the following day the celebrations for the independence of Pakistan, nobody knew where the border was, except the man in London who had drawn it. So it would be bizarre colonial situations, and so that was a pretty hard moment. I know you've done some of this last semester about India, so I don't want to repeat too much. So if we get back to England, then Indian immigration to England. By the 1970s, you have the beginnings of a political presence. Naturally enough, the immigrants who arrive the first time, quite often they're concentrating on keeping their heads down and not making noise. But their children don't feel the same way. And the Asian youth movement in the 1970s was a bit of a rebellious movement. If we move right up to today, or the last few years, we can see a big influence of Asian culture within popular music, for example. Remember, in England, when we say Asian, this means Indo-Pakistani. Et pas asiatique, il faut traduire Indo-Pakistani. And so here you have a mela at the top. You see it's an East London mela. Now, traditionally, a mela is an Indian festival, religious festival, but in Britain it's become a festival of Indian of Asian music, food, clothes, etc., where everybody can come, In fact, 2/3 of the people present are Asian, and 1/3 white or black or everybody else. Yeah. But it, these are big events, yeah, and you can see then that it is in the O2, which is a c'est peu comme Bercy, mais ça s'appelle plus Bercy, c'est Accor ou quelque chose. It's enormous. It's enormous. So this is really a big thing. But you can also see that this you can also see that they're trying to keep it cheap. It's quite cheap, and it's just a whole Accor. Yes, Accor. Now, there are a number of Asian British people you have heard of. For example, Freddie Mercury. Indeed, his original name, I can't remember his original name, but it wasn't Freddie Mercury. It was something which sounded much more Indian. And Freddie Mercury was specific because he was born in Africa because of the British colonial system. The British in Africa had an idea, the elite British in Africa had an idea. They really did not want a black middle class. And so what they did is they imported thousands and thousands of Indians, educated Indians, and they created an Indian middle class in West Africa so as to keep the situation. Of course, much later this exploded and many Indians left Africa and came to England, and this is the case of Freddie Mercury's family. In London, you can see signs of Indian religions. This is a Sikh temple. The Sikhs are, you know, the Sikh is the religion where the men don't cut their hair and they wear the turban. I don't know a lot about Sikhism, but it's a kind of interesting religion because it appears to have been established partly in order to have more equality between men and women, which is a pretty cool reason to establish a new religion, and very, very rare. We also have, of course, many Muslims in London from Pakistan, sometimes from India, but mostly from Pakistan and Bangladesh. And there you can see the East London Mosque. Within popular music, again, the rise of Asian-inspired popular music, which we call Bhangra. Bhangra is a mix between modern Western popular music and traditional Indian music. It's become very, very popular in Britain, not very well known in France. And it is rather unusual in that these are some of the first songs which are very popular in England, which are not sung in English. As you know, in France, if you want to sell a million copies of a song, you can sing in French or in English. It's not a problem to sing in English. In Britain, you sing in English, that's it. I think there are 3 French songs in the history of popular music which have been popular in England. One is Charles Aznavour, and things like that, you know. I mean, really, not necessarily very good songs. Whereas, for example, almost all French groups cannot sell songs in England, not in French. They have to sing in English because we're very narrow-minded. In any case, Bhangra has become very, very popular. They sing sometimes in English and sometimes in languages from the Indian subcontinent. And here you have Janoon, and they are from Pakistan. And this is kind of fascinating because they were born in England, but from Pakistani parents. And they sing sometimes in English and sometimes in their home language. But what is fascinating is that they are extremely popular in Pakistan. So you get these people who've come to England, mixed Pakistani music with West, and they're being exported back. And Janoon did one song which was very, very interesting. They did an instrumental with electric guitars, which is just the Pakistani national anthem in modern electronic, which obviously is very political. I mean, if some electronic band in France did the Algerian national anthem in of course it has a lot of meanings, yeah, but there's something very interesting there, Janoon, More political are people like the Asian Dove Foundation. I will try to put some links on the internet on the blog for you for these Asian Dove Foundation who sing left wing dub. But of course, a lot of the popular music that comes from India and Pakistani culture is much more singing about love and parties. Yeah, it's not all political at all. And these people, Raghav, Jaggi Dee and Veronica, these are mega stars, millionaires, who sing Bhangra music. I like Raghav because he has one of my favorite rhymes in pop music, which is the lyrics are, "You and me is ecstasy, tomorrow you'll be texting me." And I think it's just a beautiful rhyme, though. I think it's got something, yeah? Very, very, very new. So Raghav there. Desai means Asian. I don't know where the word comes from, but that's the mean from it. So if you among young people say, "Oh, I'm going out with a Desai girl," it means a girl from India or Pakistan. Yeah? I've no idea where the word comes from, if you see the word there. And there, another one, then another London Mela here. 2018 Mela. Free festival for all the family, inspired by South Asia. So this is the idea, inspired by South Asia. In the home of Bhangra. That's what you will have. London's biggest celebration of Asian culture and creativity. So there you see some of the popular culture aspects of Indian and Pakistani presence in Britain. There are also a small number of famous people. Has anybody seen this film? Yeah, somebody seen the film? Yes, Bend It Like Beckham. Fascinating film, really. It's about a young person who wants to take part in an activity which is normally for the other agenda, and their parents are very worried, and in the end, everything works out okay. In fact, it is the same film as Billy Elliot. It's exactly the same film as Billy Elliot. In fact, because Billy Elliot was very successful, they found the money for this film. But it's a good film. It's a good film. I think this is the director. The director is Gurinder Chadha. A woman director of Asian origin. You can imagine that there are not a lot of, especially 20 years ago, there were not a lot of women film directors of Asian origin. She also produced another film. Do you know any more of her films? I think you do. This one? This was translated into French under the title Coup de Foudre à Bollywood. Ça vous dit quelque chose? Yeah. Mais c'est intéressant. Souvent, on a oublié ou on ne savait pas qui était le réalisateur, c'est ça? Hein? Yeah. And she has... this is the films... These are the films of Gurinder Chadha, then. And there are more recent ones. She's brought out some new ones this year. I think they're interesting things to have a look at. In literature, British Asian people in literature, you have people like Hanif Qureshi, novelist, who is best known for this book, The Buddha of Suburbia, one of Qureshi's novels about children of Indian immigrants and questions of identity. And the actor, Ben Kingsley, who played the role of Gandhi. Now, there's a very well-known film about Gandhi, which was on French television recently, but which has been a little bit forgotten It's a 1980 film by Richard Attenborough, 3 hours long, a biography of Gandhi. Very interesting, and the first time the British wanted to make a film about the colonial past in India, which is understandable. How many French films are there about the Algerian War?
Not a lot.
Yeah, that's the way it goes. There's Ben Kingsley playing Gandhi. The other thing we have here, which is this is 2018, yeah, just a couple of years ago. This is something very, very British. This is the BBC. This is the BBC radio website, and you can see that this is the Asian network. That in the BBC radio, you have Radio 1 for pop music, Radio 2 for pop music, Radio 3 for classical music, Radio 4 for intellectuals, and then you have Asian Network. So you actually have a national British radio channel for Asian matters, which is something that, and this is, that here we are exactly within multiculturalism. There's also BBC One Extra, which is for black music. This is of course a political decision, and you've got the you've got the two arguments where some people say, oh, it's great that we have a national BBC radio specially about Asian people in Britain and Indian Pakistani, and other people say, oh, it's a pity we have a separate radio station. And this is the political argument. Yeah, it doesn't matter what your opinion is, but you need to understand this argument. Yeah, it's a pity they're separate, or it's wonderful that they're visible. Yeah, these are the two fundamental positions here. Also, 2018, one of the successful sports players, this gentleman, is a national hero in Britain. Because he is very good at cricket. Now, personally, I don't care that he's very good at cricket. But cricket is an extremely important sport in Britain. Even more in India and Pakistan, it's a national religion. You know, it's extremely important. And the best, the leading cricket player in the England team is Moeen Ali, who is of Pakistani origin. This is an article about him saying, it isn't an easy time to be a British Muslim, but the fact that a British Muslim is the leader, the leading player of the cricket team is helpful. As you probably know, yeah, a cricket match lasts for 5 days. 5 days a cricket match. The British are bizarre, because play cricket for 5 days, that's long. The British listen to cricket on the radio. But nothing happens. You just listen to cricket on the radio. It's like watching paint dry. It's an incredible phenomenon. Okay. I'm just going to check if the video works. I know the video works, but does the audio work? Fuck. Excuse my French. Just let me switch this off.